Yes, thanks a lot for the invitation. This is a bit of a funny topic to talk about because it's based on research that I did, sort of one isolated paper 1 year ago. And my motivation for thinking it's interesting now is a little different from the motivation that I had then. But I want to give you a flavor of both and then tell you some results. The big picture here is that there have been a lot of results in the last couple of years, actually in the last couple of decades, showing increasingly simple forms for scattering amplitudes in Yang-Mills theories and also in gravity. And basically trying to get to the bottom of why are these amplitudes so simple. They're much simpler than you would guess from naive Feynman diagram interpretation calculation. Why are they simple? And since this really simple form is getting amplitudes from lower point amplitudes without having to recourse to a field theory, is there some way of understanding its self-consistency and understanding the simplicity of it, but also just the self-consistency of this as a theory of interacting massless particles without going back to the Lagrangian for that derivation? So I'll save the outline of the more technical things until I've introduced some of these basic results that are the building blocks. Of this really simple picture. So sort of the first hint that scattering amplitudes are much, much nicer than you would guess from Feynman diagrams came from the Park-Taylor ansatz for maximal helicity violating MHB amplitudes. Maximally helicity violating or MHB gluon amplitudes. And what this is, first of all, any gluon amplitude can be written as some universal color structure factor times a color ordered amplitude where you've assigned a fixed set of, this is true, tree level where you've assigned a fixed ordering of the particles, and then you sum over all the permutations. And the first non-zero, so you can assign these amplitudes ordering in terms of the number of positive helicity gluons in the amplitude. For zero or one positive helicity gluons, the amplitude vanishes. Starting from two, you get a non-zero answer. This non-zero answer is extremely simple. Has this universal form independent of the number of legs. It's always just a product of two particle momentum inner products in the denominator and the fourth power of the inner product of the two plus helicity legs in the numerator. And then actually, this is just for very particular amplitudes, these MHB amplitudes with two plus helicity gluons. But there is an extremely general result for any N gluon amplitude, and it turns out to be valid for many other theories as well, besides Yang-Mills, that allows you to build a general endpoint amplitude in terms of lower point amplitudes. And this is the BCFW Brito-Pichazzo Fang-Witten recursion relations. So at a very schematic level, you're just taking some endpoint amplitude and breaking it down into a product of some k plus 1, n minus k plus 1 amplitudes, where you set some group of legs into one amplitude, and then you have the outgoing momentum from that set of legs times another one. Now on its face, without telling you something else, this relation here clearly makes no sense, because for typical values of these momenta, this intermediate leg isn't even a null vector, so it can't correspond to an amplitude involving some on-shell gluon, which is massless. So we have to change the momenta of these incoming legs for any kind of equation like this to be true. And there's a very precise way of doing it, which is what BCF found, that you take two complex, you pick two of the legs, A and B, single them out, and then there are in fact two complex momentum vectors, but we can just think about one of them, that have the property that they're null and that they're orthogonal to both A and B. So these are essentially the polarization vectors that correspond to both a valid polarization tensor for leg A and a valid polarization tensor for leg B. Now you can shift legs A and B by any multiple of this leg Q, And you'll still get another null vector because of these conditions. So if I consider some PA deformed by an arbitrary complex number z times one of these fixed Q vectors, and PB just subtracting that, I'm still conserving overall momentum. These are still null incoming legs. And I can deform, I can pick a z for any given set of legs that I put in the left factor. Pick a z such that this intermediate leg is on shell. So now this equation, this at least makes sense as inequality. Both sides are defined. And it even seems sort of plausible that there should be some connection, because after all, at these particular z's where this leg goes off shell, we know that the amplitude should have a pole corresponding to literally putting this diagram, this intermediate leg in the S channel. And I should say that I'm going to take the convention here that we can write every amplitude in terms of just incoming core momentum that's come to zero, sum to zero, and then for a real amplitude with incoming and outgoing momentum, that's just given by crossing symmetry. So now how is this equation actually realized? Well, if we think about the amplitude as being, think about an amplitude just as a function of z, then on some complex plane, there are going to be poles at different z's where these individual lines go on shell. And if the amplitude vanishes fast enough at large z, then the integral of a of z over z is equal to 0. Well, so this has all of these poles that we talked about here. It also has a pole explicitly at z equals 0, which is just with a residue that's just a of 0, the amplitude that we originally wanted to calculate. So when this function dies off fast at large z, specifically if it falls as 1 over z, this contour integral is equal to 0, and one can solve for the amplitude in terms of these poles.
Should it be obvious to me that it's always the case that an amplitude can fall with it?
No, it's far from obvious. And actually, I think that was... Yes, it's far from obvious. It's not true, for example, for phi cube theory. You know it's not true because all the vertices are momentum independent. So there are many theories, and in fact, even in the theories where it does work, it only works for some choices of the helicities of the legs. So that is the key point of proving these BCFW recursions, is to understand why an amplitude goes to zero at large z. And this has been done, as I said, for many theories. I'll give a list down the road. There's basically two categories of proofs that I'm aware of. One is diagrammatic. So essentially you build a group of Feynman diagrams that together vanish as 1 over z at large z. This is usually not true diagram by diagram. And the second that works a little more nicely for complicated theories, for example, for gravity, this is a real tour de force and incredibly complicated, but there's a second background field approach, which is much simpler in those cases, where you can just imagine, forget about the fact that all the other legs that you're not shifting, aside from these two special legs, forget that they're on shell. Just talk about general properties of an amplitude constrained by symmetry for these two particles scattering in a background field, and ask how does that vary as a function of z. So you write down some general tensor structure consistent with the symmetries. You write down the polarization tensors that you know for these legs A and B. You ask, how does this behave at large z? And with some relatively simple work, you can show that this is true in gravity for certain gluon helicities.
I think you said you were looking at what you did about.
Only true level, yeah.
A lot is known about diagrams for magnetism and crossing symmetry. In particular, the falloff is important because in local field theories, the falloff is polynomial. In string theory, perturbative string theory, it's not. This is why string theory is not local, because faster than polynomial. So showing years ago by close to time. So what can you learn about that from here?
Well, from the, sorry, what can I learn about the analyticity from this fall off? Well, actually, so what I'm going to answer sort of the other question, talk more about the other question, what can you learn about the fall off behavior from analyticity? And about the self-consistency of this BCFW formulation of the amplitudes from analyticity. It would be interesting to talk later about the other direction.
Just on two points. What you were saying, that at some level it doesn't matter whether what it does is infinite. Your contour integral still makes sense. It's just that there'll be some, as well as contributions from the finite points in the complex plane there, and also there are contributions. The difference is that you know these contributions of the finite points correspond to splittings of the energy. Mm-hmm. And you have to come up with some physical meaning for what this potential contribution is infinity, if it's there. You know, what you're going to, what it actually is, rather than just some contribution is infinity. You need to know what that contribution is. And in some cases, you can figure that out.
Mm-hmm. So what is it? In the case you can figure out what is the physical interpretation of
that? but for example, both angles of that.
All right. Yeah. So this is essentially just echoing what David just said. So there is to find out at least what the right recursion relations are for a theory. You need to understand its fall off. Things are simplest in the case that it's 1/z. You get very interesting relations in that case. And then, provided this is true, you're guaranteed that this contour integral has no contribution to infinity, and you have a simple form of the amplitude. And all right, so just to get an idea of the wide range of theories where this applies, in pure gauge theory, now we have to pick a convention for, I said there were two Qs. To talk about anything, we have to pick a convention for which Q we're talking about, so the right-handed or the left-handed Q. With respect to A. So let's say we pick the right-handed. Then if HA is minus 1, or the helicity of leg A is minus 1, or the helicity of leg B is plus 1, then you can do a valid BCFW definition and get the amplitude that way. But but for the opposite case, the helicity of A is positive 1, velocity of B is negative 1, it would not work. Likewise, if in gauge theory with matter, as long as one of the legs satisfies this condition, one of them is a gauge boson with the appropriate velocity, the other leg that you shift can be matter, and you will still be able to construct a conversion relation. At this point, I mean, this is sort of apocryphal data that I'm listing here. I can't give, it's a talk in itself to justify these. And that's not what I wanted to talk about. Likewise, for gravity, you have the same kind of rules except for helicity of minus 2, plus 2, with any matter. Once you allow gravitons, you can't do two-gauge boson transformations. This would break the interaction with gravity. And in this case, all of the amplitudes are actually falling as 1 over z squared. And that means that you have an additional relation here. That the integral, contour integral of A is 0. And there are generalizations. Benkos and Kachaza talked about one. I also wanted to include a reference to both Frank's paper here. So this allows you to reduce any amplitude in gauge theory, any amplitude with gauge theory, with gauge bosons in it, to products of lower point amplitudes by appropriate, judicious use of these recursion relations. But again, the proofs of why this works go back to these very field-theoretic arguments involving using either Feynman diagrams or background fields to figure out how the amplitudes are scaling at large Z. And it would be very nice to have some picture. This is somehow a very S matrix theoretic amplitude level result. It would be very nice to have some understanding of where it's coming from, also at the amplitude level, rather than strictly for field theory. So that was one of the things that we set out to do, with the hope that eventually this could also give us a way of playing, maybe playing with other theories, theories that have a good S matrix, but are not local field theories. Either constructing a list of them in four dimensions or proving that there aren't any, for example. But then there's a second facet of this that sort of, well, almost undermines this whole question, which is that for n equals 4 and n equals 8 supersymmetry, you get all of these simple results about the amplitudes at tree level and much more. So there's generalizations of BCFW that just work beautifully for all super Yang mills, n equals 4 super Yang mills, or n equals 8 supergravity amplitudes. There's a very simple form of the loop expansion as well, that it can be written entirely in terms of box diagrams that have no UV divergences. And all of the contributions, normally you would expect, you can reduce a general loop integral at one loop into box, triangle, and bubble terms with four, three, or two propagators. And in these cases, only the terms of four propagators, the boxes, contribute. There are extremely general formulas that can give you n equals 4 amplitudes in twister space. And part of the structure of at least the n equals 4 results is probably guaranteed not by any nice properties of S matrix theory, but by the fact that it has not only conformal invariance, but also this dual superconformal invariance. So it's an extremely symmetric theory. And this should make you wonder, at least for the pure data gravity theories, are these BCFW recursion relations, is this simplicity really something intrinsic about the S matrix? Or should I instead think that it's probably a consequence of supersymmetry? That in some sense it's an accidental result that you get because n equals 4, say, has a very nice S matrix, guaranteed by lots of symmetries. And Yang-Mills amplitudes just happen, and gluon amplitudes just happen to be the same as the n-gluon amplitudes in this supersymmetric theory. Or is it instead just actually a signal of some general properties? And the recent results have probably moved me slightly in favor of this direction, in which case the content of this talk wouldn't be very interesting. But I do think there's some evidence for this, that there's a general property as well.
So when you say recent results, you mean which recent results?
I mean just all of the progress, recent progress with n equals 4. So the magic formula stuff most recently, all of the relations between the leading singularities and the tree level amplitudes coming from the same underlying formula there. Writing everything in terms of
superconformal variance. I guess no one knows, but for example, Zvi says quite strongly that just he says it strongly, not necessarily but for n equals 8 supergravity, he very much thinks that these things are something that are not a consequence.
Right.
Historically, pure S matrix theory was abandoned in the late 60s and early 70s. If we moved into quantum field theory. And there are reasons for that, because when you write down the path integral, you can iterate all the final diagrams in any given theory. And there are a lot of things involved, like gauge fixing, DRST invariants, kind of static problems. I don't see that in pure S.
Part of the reason you don't need it in this case is that when we talk about amplitudes, you can frame it purely in terms of the physical polarization states, the plus and minus velocities. You don't ever need to talk in calculating the S matrix for higher spin particles, which is the case that was studied the least in S matrix, right? Massless high spin was the least successful case, at least from what I know, for S matrix theory. These techniques make it look significantly simpler than the massive or spin zero cases. And part of that is that it is just using the full power of using, that you can formulate things, so you can formulate things using only the on-shell, the physical helicities. That means you shouldn't need to worry about gauge fixing, you shouldn't need to worry about the RST. All of those things are necessary to define the field theory properly. And I should say, since we don't understand many of these, many properties as beyond tree level or one loop, there have been tons of programs that just get all muddled when you go to two loop in the history of gauge theories. So certainly, you know, this could all hit a brick wall when you try to go to higher loop order. But at least at tree level, there's a very consistent picture involving only the physical velocity. So you shouldn't have to worry about the RST if it holds up.
But the problem is that with pure S-matrix, you can't get off the mass shell. So you lose a lot of predictive power.
Well, yeah, you're also trying to predict fewer things. So, anyway, this is I guess all I'll say is this is a formula that works for just amplitudes in terms of lower point amplitudes. It seems like to derive, you know, we know from BCFW that to derive, at least at tree level, to derive higher point Yangmills amplitudes or gravity amplitudes, you don't need to know what's going on off the mass shell. So the amplitudes seem to have a special structure of their own. And the question is, where is that coming from and how can we understand that?
So just one last question, or over question. If it's really going to be a general property, can you say anything about the lack of mass scales or the involvement of mass scales or multiple mass scales in these sort of diagrams? So the very simple amplitude, I mean, do you also incorporate mass scales? Do you expect this to be general property for theories where you have lots of different masses and then it will also work there?
So general property is probably a much stronger term than I really want to use.
That's one you used.
I mean, general in the sense that it doesn't require large degrees of supersymmetry. But
you still don't want to do it with multiple masses.
It seems to be really most applicable to massless theories,
mm-hmm.
and even massless theories with higher spins,
mm-hmm.
where at least this version, this BCFW version of things, makes any sense.
Okay.
So it's specifically a way of deriving the interactions of higher spin particles. And that it makes good sense that would be the case. Okay, so to me, the most serious evidence that there's something correct about this way of thinking in general, that it's not just accidental for non-supersymmetric theories to have these properties, comes from studying what they do in four-point amplitudes. And this is something that Benincasa and Picciazzo wrote about in 2007. I'm going to present a slightly different version of it. But the main result is that if you try to build consistent amplitudes at four-point, there is a sense in which, in some cases, the BCFW transformations do that. When you require that they do that, all kinds of identities that we know are basic identities for field theories and for interactions of massless particles fall out just from this four-particle level of analysis. And so you can just look at four particle amplitudes properties and conclude from that which BCFW shifts are legitimate to be thinking about, and also important constraints on the amplitudes, things like Jacobi identities for gauge theories, the equivalence principle, conservation of charge, fall out from asking questions about four particle amplitudes. Using this BCFW. And then I want to talk in the second part of my talk about actually extending this from four-point to end-point. Do you have to keep checking every amplitude as you go to make sure it's consistent at 100-point? Or is that somehow guaranteed from the conditions that you put in at four-point? What I mean by that question will be clearer once I talk about the four-point. But the short answer is that no, there are general arguments that guarantee, once you've satisfied these conditions that you see at four-point, they guarantee that you're going to get a successful, consistent endpoint S matrix, by which I mean one that has the right Poincaré properties dictated by Poincaré invariance and by unitarity. You're going to get a consistent n particle S matrix at spin one. There's some interesting caveats, interesting new pieces that you need to know to understand it at spin two. So once you've done this basic test, you can argue that this is a legitimate program for constructing amplitudes. So what do we expect from an S matrix? We expect it to have Lorentz invariance, and in order to have proper transformation under Poincaré, it should also be covariant under the logarithm, by which I just mean that the matrix element should transform under a helicity rotation of each individual particle. It should transform. The amplitude should transform the same way as just a rotation of that single particle state, according to its helicity. The most useful way to keep track of this is with the spinner helicity formalism. So I will just review that very briefly. You can take any momentum, multiply it by sigma matrix to get a 2x2 matrix, P alpha alpha dot, with SV2 left and right indices. When this P vector is null, so P squared equals 0, that translates to the determinant of the matrix P being 0, which means that it's rank 1. So one can write it as a product of two spinners, conventionally lambda alpha, lambda twiddle alpha dot, with helicities minus a half plus a half. For real momenta, we always restrict to lambda being the complex conjugate of lambda twiddle. And these guys transform in the obvious way under helicity rotation by phi. So the momentum does not transform. And then one can construct polarization tensors for spin S with helicity plus S or minus S out of the lambdas and lambda twiddle for that momentum, and some auxiliary spinner mu that factors out. So in order to relate this to a sort of tensor-based theory where you have to contract polarization tensors, you need to introduce this auxiliary mu. It's the analog of a gauge choice. It corresponds to a gauge choice in the field theory for these polarizations. But the physical amplitudes shouldn't depend on mu. When we talk about building them from the ground up, we're not even going to introduce any mu's. And then we want any amplitude to transform the appropriate way. That tells you that the difference of the number of lambda twiddles and the number of lambdas in every term has to be the same, and it should just be twice the helicity of the particle. And then the third thing that we want to demand is unitarity. And at tree level, all this means is that you factorize on shell poles. So whenever there's a set I of legs that can go on a shell, as you approach that limit, P squared, the invariant mass of all of those legs, times the amplitude, should approach a product of amplitudes. Actually, it's a sum of these corresponding to different helicities. So now let's go sort of amplitude by amplitude, at least for 3 and 4 point, which are the simplest ones. Now, 3 point amplitudes aren't something that we usually...
Wouldn't you say that when you started, you tell you more than that? I mean, you imagine that you found...
Well, yeah, when you only have the... I mean, this is really all you get when all you have is a pole. There's a lot more in loop diagrams, right?
I couldn't do the same. Huh?
No, but this is all you get, right? The only imaginary part comes from the IX1 of the propagators. So it's completely equivalent to this statement.
This is, okay, maybe like, this is specifically what we're missing.
So one can define 3 point amplitudes at complex momentum. So this is a pretty natural extension. In this case, you have these lambda and lambda twiddle. You can just make it independent. That takes you to complex, you know, complex momentum. And there are two kinds of degenerate momentum configuration, where you have conservation of momentum and all three legs are null. Specifically, when all of the left-handed spinners are collinear, so lambda I dot lambda j is 0, or when all of the right-handed spinners are collinear. Let's take this first case, but we still have these right-handed spinners that can be non-degenerate, so you have non-zero inner products of the right-handed spinners associated with each momenta. This gives you some invariants. There are no scalar invariants. These have non-trivial little group properties. But there are these three invariants out of which to build amplitudes. And that lets you write down basically a unique three-point amplitude up to its coefficient. So for example, for a velocity plus one, minus one legs, the only thing you can write down is this combination, where we see, for example, that leg three, we have a velocity minus three halves in the numerator from the third power theory, velocity minus a half in the denominator. We're left getting velocity minus one for the whole amplitude, transforms correctly. There's a second thing we could have written that would transform correctly, but in the limit of real momenta, where all of these become degenerate collinear, we can see that this is going to actually, that this amplitude would diverge. So I want to restrict to considering, at tree level at least, amplitudes that are finite at real momentum. These are the things that we expect to make sense. And one can only define one of those for a given set of velocities. And just as an example, for gauge theory with scalar matter, you would have these plus minus minus and minus plus plus amplitudes with coefficients satisfying a Jacobi identity, and you could then introduce matter couplings to the gauge fields, and I won't introduce any matter collinear couplings. But all right, let's say you want to build four-point amplitudes that are consistent with the three-point structure that we talked about, which means that you need to satisfy this factorization property for when an intermediate momentum go on shell. So just to keep track of it, we have scalar invariants in this case, S, T, and U. And helicity transformations, Lorentz invariants, let you write down some general function here, which is only going to be constrained by unitarity. And then I can just multiply that by some arbitrary, so I can fix some arbitrary function that satisfies all my helicity transformations, multiply it by a general function, and solve for this function f, constrain the function f by factorization. And one subtlety that will be kind of important is that, in fact, at complex momenta, you want to apply factorization, not just at real momenta, but at complex momenta as well. And for complex momenta, in this special four-point case, we should really think separately about two limits. The limit where the left-hand spinners, say, associated with momenta 1 and 2 go to 0, is a kinematically different kind of configuration than the one where the right-handed spinners become collinear. So we'll need to make sure that it factorizes correctly in both. Now, turns out this is enough to see that the kappas satisfy the Jacobi identity. And it's really a special sort of very degenerate case of the kind of arguments that Weinberg used, the soft photon and graviton arguments, to argue that that you need charge conservation, equivalence principle, etc. This is in a very similar spirit, but just a very degenerate four-point case. So you can impose T and U channel factorization. And that guarantees, because the individual, so we're saying that the four-point amplitude in the T-channel has to factorize it as 1 over T times the product of three-point amplitudes. Those three-point amplitudes are themselves singular. So one can use that to write the amplitude uniquely as this coefficient with the right helicity properties times some scalar function. That scalar function has to be the product over T-channel kappas times 1 over ST minus a product associated with the U-channel, plus then, of course, other general terms that don't have T and U-channel poles, are unconstrained by this argument. But we know that they should only be terms that have no, that any such terms that don't introduce a double pole in X are going to have to involve higher dimension interactions, basically couplings with the mass scale. So let's just forget about that and think about only the one-dimensionless couplings, set of couplings, kappa and kappa bar. So it's basically uniquely of this form. All right. Now, we want this thing to also have the right limit in the right S-channel limit, as the right-handed spinner product, legs 1 and 2, goes to 0. And, you know, we multiply it by S. It's easy to see that mu is going to minus t in that limit, so I can just write it as a single factor over t times this. But what we know we should get is something in this form. This looks very similar to what I wrote up here for the t-channel, and it's really quite analogous. So this can only be satisfied. A function consistent with the t and u channel limits can only satisfy the s-channel factorization condition if these numerators are equal. But the equality of these numerators is just the Jacobian identity on these kappas. Now, how does this relate at all to BCFW? Well, we could have gotten, I just declared this T and U channel limit. One can get it by specifically considering factorization of those channels, or one can recall that BCFW is a construction that's specifically picking out those two poles. And it's just guaranteed to get correct. So if we consider, for example, a BCFW shift of legs 1 and 2, in this case, now we can really think of the shift as just changing two of the spinners, the right-handed spinner associated with leg 1 and the left-handed spinner associated with leg 2. There are two terms, and each one is controlled by one of the two factorization limits. So this one is controlled by the t-channel limit, this one's controlled by the u-channel limit. We don't get an S-channel pole term here because the BCFW construction only gives diagrams where legs 1 and 2 are on opposite sides of the diagram. So, first of all, it's clear that this BCFW construction, as written, would never give a sensible answer that has any nice behavior in the S-channel, except for the fact that these vertices are momentum dependent. Right? Somehow we need to get, this expression here needs to know about the 1 over S singular behavior. But also, you know that the minute you have that, the minute you have denominators in these amplitudes, you're going to get some kind of consistency condition on the coefficients from demanding that that 1 over S pole has the right coefficient. And so this is just a slightly more explicit demonstration of the exact same argument, but at the same schematic level. I just want to say that one can do very similar calculations considering amplitudes with matter that show not only the Jacobi identity, but also that these interaction vertices I defined earlier for the matter need to be in representations of the algebra defined by the kappas. And you can also show that charge is conserved in any three-point matter vertex. So all of the essential things that we know must be satisfied by interactions in a gauge theory can also be derived by requiring consistency of these factorization limits at 4-point amplitudes, and any time you have a consistency condition on 4-point amplitudes for factorizations, it's associated with a denominator, which in vertices, which also allows you to write down a BCFW construction, at least at the 4-point level. One can do the same thing and try. We know I said that only some subset of BCFW shifts give you valid answers. one can shift the wrong things, and when you do, you get manifestly unphysical results for the other poles. For example, if you're shifting the wrong velocities in a gauge theory amplitude, you get funny things with x to the fourth denominators. And in gravity, you can do exactly the same kind of calculation. Here, instead of one power of s in the denominator, from the three-point amplitudes, you get two powers of s in the denominator. And so now we know that to get the right behavior in the s-channel limit, first, we have a double pole that we need to get rid of. And second, you better hope that the single pole has the correct limit. And this is probably the first hint that there's something going on in gravity beyond BCFW. Because you need two things to be true, and they're automatically satisfied by the same choice of couplings. So it'd be nice to sort of separate them more cleanly. But you can see that if these coefficients are the same, then you would have a t plus u dependence in the numerator from summing them, which just gives you minus s, and that can cancel. So from this, you get the fact that all of these products of kappa are the same. Essentially, this is a commutative and associative algebra, and that tells you that if I write down a theory of n gravitons, they all have to, you can rewrite it in such a way that all n of the gravitons are decoupled from each other and just interacting with themselves.
So one thing people often point out is that this looks an awful lot like bootstrapping incorporating functions in CO2. You're asking some consistency of the way you.
Right.
Have you thought about that at all?
I haven't. Yeah, I haven't either. But you're right, it does. So, okay, we're putting in a somewhat strange set of requirements. It's not really that strange of a set. In one way of looking at it, in another way it is. We're requiring that we're really just requiring factorization and asking what is the factorization of an amplitude in non-trivial condition. That's couplings. But another way of saying it is that you're testing out unsatzes for BCFW shifts at 4-point. Does it give anything sensible? And what you find is that there are bad shifts where it clearly produces nonsense. And you know that it can't possibly give you reasonable amplitude, so you throw that shift out. There are cases where where BCFW recursion at 4-point can give you a reasonable amplitude. But only, and in those cases, always associated with some consistency condition on the 3-point amplitudes. So you can take these good shifts and the consistency conditions and use them to define something that you tentatively want to call a theory, because it's giving me rules to define things that I can call endpoint amplitudes. I can call them that, but I should be careful because there is no reason at face value to think that a 6-point amplitude that I calculate from this procedure, this odd rule BCFW, and some set of vertices, there's no intrinsic reason to think that that's going to be a sensible amplitude. So it's an ansatz for a theory. For a way of defining a set of amplitudes at tree level up to infinitely many points. But we want to know whether it makes sense. And so that's what I'm going to turn to now. For spin 1, we can show in a totally self-consistent way that the set of amplitudes makes sense, at least the level that it respects the three properties that I discussed earlier. For gravity, it will not be so simple because this 1 over z squared fall off that I mentioned earlier as being a property of gravity amplitudes actually plays a crucial role in guaranteeing that some of these factorization limits, some of these on-shell limits factorize correctly. And I don't know of any way of deriving this 1 over z squared behavior outside of field theory. So without that, we can't say anything as strong about gravity. But for spin 1, you take simply these some rather simple arguments, combine them with Jacobi identities that followed from this four-point consideration, and that's enough to ensure that the amplitudes have all the right factorization poles. So what we want to show is that we have factorization on all physical poles, that we don't have any of these strange unphysical double or higher poles like I showed earlier. And then there's a third condition that I wish I had more to say about, which is that there are no spurious poles. So spurious poles are things that appear in the BCFW construction. Because you're evaluating amplitudes at different momenta, you can end up with funny denominators that in individual terms of the BCFW calculation that don't correspond to anything that by right is a physical singularity. They always cancel, and there are various ways of understanding why they cancel. But from this sort of S-matrix perspective, it's still non-trivial. Why they should cancel. There are definitely constraints on the forms if you satisfy these two conditions. There are definitely constraints on the form of any term that has spurious poles because it has to sort of, it has to persist level by level in the amplitude without ever violating these conditions. So the way that physical poles appear in a term with spurious poles would be very constrained. But I don't think it's enough to completely rule out the presence of spurious poles.
In the S-matrix theory, if you go into the complex P squared plane, you get branch cuts. And for physical S-matrix amplitude, all the poles have to be in the first Riemann sheet. Otherwise, the theory doesn't work as far as locality is concerned. So, do all your poles appear correctly?
That's going
to
be a tree level
turnover. There are tree level poles.
No branch cuts, so we don't see.
So there are no.
It's just a rational function.
It's what?
Yeah.
The tree amplitude is just a rational function of the branch.
So, I mean, this is probably particularly unenlightening, but one can classify all the poles and just ask what's. There's a set of poles that are obviously going to be correct just by the definition of the BCFW recursion, which by design ensures that the amplitude factorizes on the poles that were used to define it. But then there's a set of poles that are much harder. So some of these are poles that just where the, as you shift legs 1 and 2, they're on the same side of the pole. So in some sense, the BCFW transformation, the BCFW shift in Z isn't changing the momenta that would give you this pole. And I've divided them up basically depending on the number of poles in each set. So for some, there's some interesting things that happen when we're considering a pole where there's only two legs on one side and then the two legs that we're shifting are in the other group with everybody else in the amplitude. Other interesting things happen when you consider the opposite limit where the two legs that you're shifting in BCFW are on one side, everybody else is over here. And then there's a third category, which is also sort of subtle in a different way. This is where the gravity conditions will come from, which these poles actually look a lot like the ones that I drew over here. Where leg one and one other amplitude, one other leg appear on one side of the pole. So I'm taking just a two-particle collinear limit, and I expect this kind of factorization, but I'm taking a different two-particle collinear limit, the other degenerate configuration from the one that I was guaranteed to get right things. So I'm going to talk briefly about these two. I won't say much about this pole because it's very much the same conditions. And then, in specialized here to gauge theories, and then I'll talk a little bit about what's going on in basic gravity. So this first kind of pole where I just have, I realize this is a very massive figure. Some generic set of legs that I'm interested in, and I'm interested in taking this generic set of legs I that does not include the shifted legs 1 and 2. Ask what happens when the invariant mass of this set I becomes null. When I do that, I can just write out the full BCFW expansion, and I'll only care about terms where all of the legs I in BCFW appeared on the same half of the amplitude. Something where it's all on the left or all on the right. Anything where I had some subset of these legs on the left, sub-amplitude, some subset on the right, wouldn't have any singularities in this pi squared goes to zero limit. But these terms do. I can just draw it diagrammatically as pulling off a little amplitude corresponding to I and pi on the other side. And then if you look at this term, well, this is just a BCFW sum itself for some lower point amplitude times the I. So basically, the pole of the BCF sum is equal to a BCF sum times a pole. And there's just this sort of simple diagrammatic reason to expect. Actually, these, even though I labeled them as hard, these are very simple poles coming from BCFW. But when I has only two legs, things get much more interesting. And the reason I can try to carry out the same argument, so now I'm just labeling them I and j. But this term here actually doesn't have the right singularity that we want to get the relevant term in the final line, the factorized pole times the BCFW sum. It's just in the wrong degenerate dimension. Instead, there are these other terms that I left off upon in my new story, where I is on this side, leg J is over here, or the other way around. And these guys, because this term in BCFW has the same right-handed spinner component on this intermediate leg as I. When ij goes to zero, these two guys here are also going into a collinear limit. And so this still has a singularity in the limit that I and j become collinear. And now I'm really getting, again, a Jacobi identity out of this, here this is a Jacobi identity now in terms of just the kappas. The Jacobi identity we saw at 4-point involved the kappa bars. So to the extent that you took parity as an ansatz, you would say this is the same identity. Kappa should equal the kappa bars. If you don't want to assume parity from the get-go, I guess you would count this as a second assumption. But it's one assumption that once and for all guarantees that this class of poles maximize. And in fact, this Jacobi identity is also sufficient to show that third class of poles that I mentioned, these unique diagrams, vanish, although here you would have to use it repeatedly, use the full gauge structure, but it's just the Jacobi identity over and over again. So now there's something much more interesting at work in these wrong helicity poles. So again, I said this, what you distinguish between this limit where the right-handed spinners of 1 and I, and some other like I, become collinear, are the limit where the right-handed spinners become collinear. These are really different kinematics, and you're plugging in a different 3-point amplitude on the left or the right with different intermediate helicities that play a role. So these are not trivially equivalent. This one is explicitly guaranteed. It's included in the BCFW formula. You know it should be there, and it should factorize correctly. But this one's not trivial. And in fact, this obvious diagram that you get from BCFW, this term, is not singular in this limit, at least for higher spins. So it has to come from elsewhere. And in fact, there are two contributions to keep track of. There's one contribution where I just have like two instead of like one in a 3-point amplitude. And you can just do power counting on this. First notice that the z at which this is evaluated at BCFW. What's happening that makes this amplitude singular is that the z at which you evaluate it, the shifted momentum, is going off with infinity. So you're actually deforming from the original kinematics by a very large momentum shift that grows without bound as those two legs become collinear. And you can see that if the product of these two amplitudes grows at large z, then you would get a singularity, a singular contribution here to the pole. But if it doesn't grow at large z, you get no contribution. Then the second set of terms are just these, this is going to look fairly similar to my last argument, where you have some additional legs here, and then you have some big amplitude in BCFW that factorizes. And this now looks a lot like just a BCFW sum itself. If I forgot completely about this three-point amplitude, I would have precisely a BCFW sum. But for general spins, this three-point amplitude is different at different poles. So we'll need to be a bit careful about these contributions B as well. Right. In particular, one can basically replace this by an overall constant to the amplitude at the unshifted momentum 1 times the ratio of the 1-3 shifted to the unshifted spinner invariant to the power s minus 1. So for s equals 1, it's just a constant, and this thing that that looks like the amplitude times BCFW with the sum in the wrong place really is just a three-point amplitude times BCFW. But let me write it a little more generally. In terms of for general spins s, I can just substitute in the shifted momentum. And there's just this 1 plus z times a constant raised to this power. So again, for s equals 1, this vanishes, and this term is just giving you the BCFW integral, a of z over z. Also, for spin 1, the product of amplitudes in the first term, you can check just using power counting and helicity arguments. You can check that the total scaling should be 1. So for all of the good shifts, so either they're staying flat or they're falling, and these terms don't contribute to the pole. But it requires that you know something about the boundary behavior of the amplitude. But it's something about the boundary behavior of the amplitude that you can conclude from very simple arguments. On the other hand, for gravity, now we have two sort of hard, both of these things become more solid. Point A, you need to understand more about the behavior of the amplitude at large z in order to calculate either the first or the second contributions. So if the large z scaling of the endpoint amplitude is like three-point scaling, and in fact we know from field theory that it is, but I don't have any sort of S-matrix justification for that. If we knew that this is true, then we know that there's no contribution for A. And likewise, if we knew that, we could use the second identity, the 1 over z squared identity, to conclude that the amplitude is, that the second term vanishes in part B. And again, we'd just be left getting the right answer, that this factorization limit in this pole is just a three-point amplitude times the BCF expression for a lower point amplitude. But unlike what happened in Yang-Mills, there's not a clear way of deriving within this S-matrix context. There's not a clear way of deriving this 1 over z squared scaling. So it seems still very non-trivial that this pole would actually give us the correct answer. In other words, we need to understand this 1 over z squared scaling. It's crucial to guaranteeing that BCFW gives you the correct amplitudes, the proper behavior. This is not at all obvious from the field theory perspective. The field theory is guaranteeing you that that as long as the amplitude falls as 1 over z, you will get consistent amplitudes out of this BCFW procedure. But if you didn't know that it was described by a consistent field theory, you would need to also see this one over to Z squared in some way. That the amplitudes you're getting make any sense at all. All right, I won't spend time talking about 1 over z squared. And then I think there's another sort of amusing possibility that this argument suggests, I'll just throw out there, that in gauge theory and in gravity, we know more things about the amplitudes than I can prove in this very rigid constructive framework. We know that these terms A and B vanish. I don't know of any examples in where you have a valid BCFW construction. Where these things don't vanish, but in principle, it seems possible that A and B could, instead of like these two terms, could, that this extra term that we don't like, B, could in fact cancel a contribution from A. That would be a different way of generating a consistent set of amplitudes. It'd be interesting to see whether such theories exist. So, all right, all of this is, in a sense, inconclusive. I think it does hint that there is a general structure to be understood where S matrix consistency is tied to the ability to write down recursive formulas for amplitudes, and BCFW is just probably just a special case associated with high spin fields. But what we do have is that four-point amplitudes from BCFW are a recipe for generating identities that we know to be important. And in fact, basically any identity on the couplings of, on the interactions of higher spin particles, every identity that I know of, at least, can be derived from some sort of BCFW consistency argument at 4-point. Now, I mean, that's very suggestive. It's not obvious why it should be true, but this is singling out only the theories that we know from independent arguments make sense. And in all the known examples, one can use this four-point particle test, clearly a necessary condition for this BCFW to make sense. If it fails at 4-point, it's no good. But it appears to be a sufficient condition. Anything that works at 4-point also goes on and constructs a full and particle S matrix that has good properties. So that is, if you've shown that it says up to the spurious full caveat, unique in the sense that different BCFWs are definitely constructing the same S matrix, or I mean, you can always add higher order
coupling. You shift, you check it's works at 4-point, and it does.
Yeah.
Do you then carry on doing BCFW and get the unique answer by
So all the examples that that work at 4-point, at least a wide variety of them, just match onto consistent field theories. So we know the BCFW. We know from the field theory arguments that they must carry on at 5-point and higher. Now,
So your consistency condition engaged in spin one theory was simply that it was gauged.
Right.
That's simply structure constant.
Yeah. And then we have a consistency condition on which BCF shifts make any sense at 3-point. And it's all the right BCF shifts. And then,
How would you know that if I wanted to be stupid and confused in terms of regression, how would you know that there aren't higher order curvatures? What was the right piece of curvature?
Well, with higher order curvature terms, you can't write down any piece of curvatures, right? So this is just guaranteeing. Those interactions have higher powers of momentum, right? So it's not going to have one over C. Yeah. So you only get in the lowest order derivative, only the theory of the lowest order derivative interactions. Now, whether you can play BCFW with boundary term games in those cases, I don't know. So it generates one theory. Certainly, there are other theories like gauge theory with higher curvature interactions that would not be generated by this procedure. But So it gives you the Jacobi identities.
I still don't see where that quite came in. I mean, you fixed your three-point amplitudes just by Lorentz invariants in the right little group scaling.
Yeah. So I put it written down. I put it written down.
The shift was just that there'll be a Jacobi.
Right. Now, I could have also written down a, let's say, an all plus amplitude, which you generally get in higher correction theories. And if I did that, I would not have been able to get to find any VCFW shifts that worked in 4.1. Of course, I could still add new four particle operators that scale as STU and never see those for the pole structure. But that's a separate class. In that sense, it's not unique. Now, there's a separate question: are all my VCFW answers going to be the same as each other? I haven't specifically addressed that. We know that they are up to spurious poles. I believe Song He wrote a temporary paper with ours, did directly address our this question: are two VCFW shifts going to be the same? Show that they do. Our approach doesn't really show that as clearly because of the spurious poles. And you can always imagine there's something with only spurious poles that differs between VCF shift number one and VCF. But okay, so at least for it, nonetheless, we can show that they're consistent up to the spurious pole caveat for the spin one case. This argument breaks down badly for spin 2 because it relies on the one over these spread scaling. I should say that the poles where I didn't talk about gravity, those ones, the arguments carry through very much the same way as in gauge theory. It's really just this particular example where spin 2 is solid. And, all right, so there's partial success for understanding, ACFW amplitudes, self-consistent framework of their own for spin 1. If one wanted to extend it to spin 2, there are clearly new ingredients that are necessary.
I'm going to return to my first question. In the 60s, it was learned that if you impose proxy symmetry, unitarity, analyticity, and locality. It's very restrictive. It imposes very restrictive conditions in scattering amplitudes. For example, the Mandelstam representation for 4-point amplitudes. So what if I take this VCFW in a tree level? Do I satisfy these conditions?
Yeah, I mean, and by the way, you know it must because for at least for cases for pure spin one, you know it must because it's been proven by other arguments to be completely identical to Yang knows, which we know satisfies them. But in addition, these consistency conditions that I'm requiring are extremely similar to those. For example, this unique diagram pole, the sum of terms that you get in checking the consistency of this pole. This is precisely a sum of soft limits around an n-1 point amplitude, where you add one extra gluon. This is precisely the soft limit that Weinberg used to get the consistency conservation of charge on the lower point amplitudes. It's not an accident that they satisfy these conditions because I'm imposing very similar ones myself.
I have another question. At some point, you have to connect to the path integral quantum field theory, which is what we're using today, the standard model calculations. And if you don't, because the IE noise is very subtle, it's got these ghost fields, gauge fixing, da 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 da, all of this has to work. You do standard model calculations, which we do every day for the LAC. So how do you connect to all this? And if not, why not?
Well, there's two subtleties in connecting to the standard model. One is just adding masses. And that's a big subtlety. And some of the, certainly the approach I've been taking is to just ignore masses, think about massless theories. And there has been a tremendous, I'll just say there's been a tremendous success for massless theories, also with extensions to massive theories, of using these generalized unitarity methods in BCFW to calculate amplitudes that do not require talking about ghost fields. They really just, they're really just talking about the scattering amplitudes. In fact, a lot of the NLO Monte Carlo that people use for the LHC is based on amplitude level, not precisely BCFW, but based on amplitude level generalized unitarity arguments, rather than keeping track of the ghost fields, just because it's computationally easier. But I mean, case by case where you need it, you show that it's equivalent. You understand these shortcuts. But there would be a desire, of course, to understand more generally what's the structure of these generalized unitarity formulas that work. Where is it coming from? And are they just tricks, or are they reflecting some underlying extra structure of the theory that's not obvious when you force yourself to write it in terms of a local one?
You emphasize in the beginning that this is something that most of the supersymmetry doesn't have to do anything with the supersymmetry, right?
Yeah.
Is there any known example, if you add method, that the amplitude you generate in these CFW rules cannot be embedded in the three-level amplitude of some supersymmetry?
Well, once you start adding matter, there's you can only use BCFW with the gauge bosons to get down to amplitudes involving just matter. Right? So I can imagine if I have matter-matter interactions, then I will always be able to break things down to products of amplitudes involving gauge bosons that I can reduce down to three-point amplitudes, and some big, n scalar interaction vertex that I have to specify, interaction amplitude, sorry, that I have to specify some other way. You can say that those are zero, and then that is certainly not Gangels. Sorry, that's certainly not a meta.
If those exist in 1-0, you will probably not have the one with Z.
Yeah, well, actually, so there's a sort of amusing case where, at least at 4-point, it looks like there are hints that N equals 1 supersymmetry has these 1 over Z, these 1 over Z scalings, even for matter-matter shifts. But anyway, I'd say that's N equals 1, not N equals 4.
Any final questions?
We're going to open a new table.
Well, this is all tree level. There's an infinite amount to say about loop diagrams that I have not said.
If you really want to think about this.
Yeah, so everything becomes much more complicated at loop level because you start, if you want to take this kind of sort of extreme S-matrix program, that becomes significantly more subtle at loop level. I think the true structure of the loop amplitudes in anything other than N equals 4, possibly even in N equals 4, is still sufficiently cobbled together that it would be really hard to even attempt this. But I honestly haven't thought that hard.
Okay, so let's thank Natalia again. Thank you.